Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And with that, I think we're, you know, doing what we're doing with this small portion of Federalist Papers, and what we're, I'm going to try, folks, my best to go through Hamilton's discourses, because if I remember correctly, if I look at all of Hamilton's discourses, I think he only spoke, what, maybe 10 times? Just trying to remember how many times Hamilton's. And so as I meander here, I'll try to come up with how many times he orated in the entire debates. Now, as we look at, you know, what we're going through with the Federalist Papers and everything else, then what we need to do is, you know, help you see. Now, these are the jurist, you know, these are the Federalist Papers that Hamilton tucked into the Constitution that explained the powers of the judiciary. This was all done after the Constitution had been ratified. There were no more debates. What he was basically doing was putting onto paper arguments to allow the judiciary to assume unconstitutional powers. Nothing more, nothing less. Therefore, so what Hamilton was putting into these Federalist Papers that we're reading now, we really want to go through these, and unfortunately, we want to go through these comprehensively, because as we read through these things, there is a very, very tight, very, very tight weaving and webbing of ideas and propositions, powers, and implications for the court to function well beyond what the Constitution has basically delegated to them, and how the ratification debates contained them as well. How it was defined in the ratification debates that the court couldn't do these types of things, that their jurisdiction was limited to those enumerated objects, so forth and so on. So Hamilton was literally contradicting everything that was being said in the ratification debates. This is why yesterday I went through a long oration on what and why primary source documents are so critical, and to question how in the heck, as a matter of fact, even Sean yesterday commented, how in the heck did we get to this point? How did the Federalist Papers ever get to be what they are today? I think you did that on air. If you didn't, I will give you the credit, because it's worth that question is worth answering. How is it that the Federalist Papers have risen to the level that they don't deserve? And how did these questionable documents, you know, get embraced? And why did everybody just watch this whole nation go sideways and completely, you know, convert itself from a Republican form of government into a judiciary form of government without anybody mentioning or complaining? Because nobody questioned the wise men in black. They were the elevated portion of our society. They were the oracles. They knew all. In a way, the oracles were the ones, if you really think about this, folks, it was the oracles that were the ones that created basically the Antichrist Church, because it was through edicts that they basically started saying, thou shalt not have any god greater than your god, us, the Supreme Court, and your government, that we will decide what you teach in school, and it will not be the Bible and Christ. It will be godlessness and evolution. And clearly, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the ratification debates laid out the fact that they could not do these things. And yet, it took a little over a century and a half almost, right? Because the Scopes trial was in 1920. That's almost 150 years later, after the Declaration of Independence, almost 150 years later, that the court was establishing and building the Antichrist Church. But they did it without brick and mortar. They did it with authority that if you want to wander across this line that they drawn in the sand, then they will crush you. And this is how we're in this position today. They had to get elevated to that point. And so it took that 150 years to empower them more, empower them more. And what scares me is good patriots are believing these lies that the court has these powers that is being purported by, you know, the state nationals and all these other different movements. Though, if you read these cases, you know, they did these things like they had the power to do those things, and they don't. The courts never had the power to do these things. They didn't have the power to redefine stuff. They didn't have the power to, you know, to legislate, create these laws, redefine, on and on and on. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
So
I just had a thought of the Federalist Papers like a sorcerer's stone for them to turn lead into gold.
Yeah, so everything prior to this is kind of insightful. But be careful, folks, that they're just hearsay. This is just these smart men talking about, you know, what they were doing and so forth, and helping, you know, expand upon the ideas of the Constitution. They were never, ever intended. So one of the things that I prove is I've yet to find any document. I've yet to find any source. So if somebody would back me with $1 million to show me, you know, a document where Madison recommended the Federalist Papers as the guide for the Constitution, the father of the Constitution himself said that this is what we're supposed to be following, then I'd give you $1 million if I had it. I would pat you on the back and I would say, there you go, therefore, go be prosperous and do good things. That's about all I can do. You know, because you've proven me wrong. But I'm here to tell you folks that that evidence does not exist. That if any evidence ever came forward, you want to examine whether it's a product of AI or some type of deceit and treachery. That we are literally being lied to. And now that we have the technology and the capability of being very treacherous, they can produce videos now, folks. As a matter of fact, there are actors in Hollywood that have sued over, you know, fake actions. I think Keanu Reeves has complained about one point in a movie where they manufactured him crying. He didn't cry. That wasn't a part of the script. That didn't happen. It was fake. And I forget what they call it, fake something. But anyway, it is
deep fake, perhaps.
What's that?
Deepfake, perhaps.
Yes,
deepfake. There's also actors who are going along with it, and that way they can get the parts and the credits in the movie, even though they're not actually filming the scenes. So they get the AI version of themselves created, and then they can manipulate it in any way they want, and the actors don't actually have to go through the process of filming the scene.
Okay. So
I'm not saying that's a good thing saying there's those that are going along with it. And you're remarking about Keanu Reeves. He seems to be one of the good guys.
Yeah, no, no. Theater. So you're just basically saying, and I'm not surprised, that there are a whole bunch of people that are jumping and leaping forward, running forward to the opportunity to selling their souls. Do not forget, folks, that lawyers, actors, entertainers, such as actors, musicians, new journalists. There is a very large breadth of professions that their job has become the art of lying and the art of deception. And, you know, a journalist can be held accountable for libel, but most of these big institutions, when it comes to the lies of the deep fake, the lies of the deep state, so forth and so on, I mean, those institutions will protect that, but they will go after anybody that is trying to expose the truth, if they can get you in a nuance to say that's libel. This is why I'm being libeled left and right, because I'm not out here trying to make friends with organizations that are deceiving you. And, oh, boy, it's just it's a terrible thing to hear about the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPC, or, yeah, Southern, SPLC.
PLC.
Yeah. So, anyway, let's dive into it. Oh, by the way, Hamilton made 12 orations of the during the ratification debates. And that the ratification debates in New York, 12 times, and the date spanned from the 17th of September, or 17th of June, all the way into at least the end of July, or the beginning of July. I think it went even further. But when we look at the Federalist Papers, we look at these Federalist Papers, Hamilton was busy in creating these Federalist Papers that the ones we're currently reading, these were done on the 25th and the 28th of June. Guess what? He was deep in the heart of the ratification debates when he was writing these.
But he didn't publish them until after.
Well, he never did. He never published them. He just basically added them, super added them to a finished document. And whether he actually sent this finished document to Hamilton, to Madison, I'd like to see anybody produce a Madison's copy of the Federalist Papers. Because when Madison went back to Virginia, he sent out a copy of the Federalist Papers that he had. He made a copy and sent them out to George Washington and a lot of other people. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts that what he sent out did not include these 8 Federalist Papers that Hamilton super added to it. I'd love to see evidence that Madison had basically received the Federalist Papers, because I'll bet you he was a pretty thorough man. I'll bet you anything he would have read it. And had he saw these last 8 Federalist Papers, going, hold on here, judiciary, when did we talk about the judiciary? Uh-oh, I better read this. And he would have called Hamilton out big time. I think this was one of the reasons why the Federalist Papers were really kind of suppressed, and that the courts kind of danced around these 8 mystical Federalist Papers until much later, when Madison was no longer, because Madison was really a hands-off guy. He was a small guy. He was not one of those guys who wanted to get up and challenge people or anything like that. I mean, he had no reservations in, you know, standing up and trying to do the right thing. Don't get me wrong. But after he stepped back and after he got out of the presidency, he really, you know, he wasn't sucking up to try to find, you know, relevance in post-presidential, you know, life. You know, he had a family. He had a wife to take care of and so forth. And he was working on his notes on the Constitutional Convention to produce that book. I mean, he had those types of things to do. But there's no doubt in my mind, had he seen the Federalist Papers and these 7 or 8 Federalist Papers that Hamilton tucked in, I go back and forth between these, so I constantly confuse these two men. But there's no doubt in my mind, Madison would have called Hamilton out. Hamilton being dead at the time, it's almost like, well, what's the point, right? But he should have at least, there's no doubt he would have at least warned people, hey, these Federalist Papers are subversive. That's why I don't think he ever got a copy of the full Federalist Papers that we have today. It's kind of like, you know, taking books out of the Bible kind of thing. When you give it to, you know, the hands of the other creator would have easily been able to call him out. And that's why I think the publications of the Federalist Papers were quasi-suppressed for the most part. They were mentioned, but they weren't, you know, they weren't out there where everybody was buying them like they are today. I mean, how many people basically puff their chest up and say, I've read the Federalist Papers, like they've read the Bible? Oh, my gosh. That's the problem. You've read the Federalist Papers. Okay. So,
yes, sir.
So anyway, I think we kind of left off with 7, and we're now diving into 8. So of the 81st Federalist Paper. So paragraph 8, if you would please, sir, go ahead.
It is not true, in the second place, that the Parliament of Great Britain or the legislatures of the particular states can rectify the exceptional decisions of their respective courts in any other sense than might be done by a future legislature of the United States. The theory neither of the British nor the state constitutions authorizes the revisal of a judicial sentence by a legislative act, nor is there anything in the proposed constitution more than in either of them by which it is forbidden. In the former as well as in the latter, the impropriety of the thing on the general principles of law and reason is the sole obstacle. A legislature, without exceeding its province, cannot reverse a determination once made in a particular case, though it may prescribe a new rule for future cases. This is the principle, and it applies in all its consequences, exactly in the same manner and extent to the state governments as to the national government now under consideration. Not the least difference can be pointed out in any view of the subject.
Okay, so there's a lot here. And what he's basically saying is that the legislature is incapable of correcting a wrong. Is he right? Is he correct?
I don't think so. I don't see how that makes any sense.
Okay, so this is what he says. This is what you read. It's the last middle part. Nor is there anything in the proposed Constitution more than in either of them by which it is forbidden. Let me go up, because what you read before that is important. It is not true, in the second place, that the Parliament of Great Britain or the legislatures of the particular states can rectify the exceptional decisions of their respective courts in any other sense than might be done by future legislation of the United States. There may not be any legislation where it is left to the state governments or left to the British government, but let's examine the Articles of Confederation. The Continental Congress does have the power of regulating the judiciary, but they basically are the ones that establish the judiciary case by case for it to be tried and move forward. Can they overturn, an outcome from the court? Can a legislative body redress the grievances that may come from a bad determination by the court? That's the question I'm asking here. Can they do that? Absolutely.
Yeah.
They are the sovereigns. They can basically say no. The ruling and the logic behind the ruling is unfounded, and they can actually overturn it. So there's nowhere in here where Hamilton is speaking about the right of petition for the redress of grievances. The court is not designed to deal with grievances. It's only to adjudicate a conflict between one party and another, or multiple parties. It is literally...
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm kind of confused a little bit about what he means by that. But so if the legislature passes a law and the court says that it's unconstitutional, but the legislature can only pass laws that are under the power that they're delegated, correct?
Well, so in the Articles of Confederation, they weren't given a lot of the abilities to create law, right? In the Articles of Confederation. But is he talking here about that? He says right here that the Parliament of Great Britain or the legislatures of the particular states. Is he mentioning the Continental Congress? He's not mentioning Continental Congress, because Continental Congress was very limited and defined. And this U.S. constitutional government was going to be very limited and defined as well. See, the big nuance here.
That's exactly right. That's the part that's like, where does this even come from?
Right. So, okay. So you could answer your question when you really re-examine what is he using for the examples. The examples are there are these bad governments, the states and Britain, and you know they can't overturn these things. Ah, but the courts, you know, can do things, and Continental Congress and the Congress or the legislature under the Constitution, under this new founded Constitution, they can redress these grievances. They can redress any problem that is presented them. And they have the power in the Constitution to regulate the courts and to basically, you know, create their rules and their procedures and oversee them. The courts really have no power. They're there to provide justice between a conflict of parties. I keep saying this in different ways. But that's the court's job, is to make a ruling in a conflict between parties. Whatever the controversy is, they're to basically determine, based on law and fact, who should be, you know, either have their grievances redressed or what have you. What should happen? They provide that outcome. But if the court actually exceeds their powers and tries to rewrite law, such as in a decision like Baker v. Carver, Reynolds v. Sims, where they created one person, one vote, absolutely, Congress should actually have stepped in and said, you have no power to create law. You overreached your bounds. Here's the problem, folks. When Congress benefits by the court's rulings, by giving the court more power and creating more laws that helps Congress, why would Congress stand up and stop the courts from doing these bad things? They're benefiting from it.
Yeah, and they're obfuscating the blame or the responsibility.
Correct, correct. But Hamilton right here is setting this all up. This is perfect. This is beautiful. This is a huge setup for allowing, you know, the courts to literally have the ultimate say, where the legislature, he's saying, they can't do it. And everybody is going to consider the implication that that must be applied to the Supreme Court and the constitutional government that's being created here. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir. When they only had specific enumerated powers.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Okay, great. So let's move into the next one. Let's go to
number nine.
Number nine.
It may in the last place be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is in reality a phantom. Particular misconstructions and contraventions of the will of the legislature may now and then happen, but they can never be so extensive as to amount to an inconvenience or in any sensible degree to affect the order of the political system. This may be inferred with certainty from the general nature of the judicial power, from the objects to which it relates, from the manner in which it is exercised, from its comparative weakness, and from its total incapacity to support its usurpation by force. And the inference is greatly fortified by the consideration of the important constitutional check which the power of instituting impeachments in one part of the legislative body and of determining upon them in the other would give to that body upon the members of the judicial department. This is alone complete security. There never can be danger that the judges, by a series of deliberate usurpations on the authority of the legislature, would hazard the united resentment of the body entrusted with it, while this body was possessed of the means of punishing their presumption by degrading them from their stations. While this ought to remove all apprehensions on the subject, it affords at the same time a cogent argument for constituting the Senate a court for the trial of impeachments. Okay. He's talking out of both sides of his mouth. Because
yeah, yeah. So
didn't he say before?
We got to go, folks. We've got this break, so we got to go.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so boy, did we bleed right up to that moment where we went into break. So, sorry about that, folks, and sorry, Sean, I should have noticed that.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, so I got more caught up in the time left than really what you were kind of reading. And so I apologize about that. But here's the interesting thing, because I highlighted this before. This is where Hamilton starts becoming very deceitful, because, I mean, he uses red herring and phantom, you know, as this, like an accusation that these other people are fear-mongering. And he starts this whole sentence off, he starts this whole paragraph off with the use of, in reality, a phantom. In other words, there's nothing there. It may in the last place be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is in reality a phantom. It can't be. They can't encroach. It's impossible. That's what he just said. And yet we see it where they're legislating. They have completely encroached. They are creating law. And so everything he says out here to kind of support this is literally, you know, talking out, you know, the back of his mouth. I mean, it's coming out the back of his head. You don't even see his lips moving. It's the pure art of ventriloquism.
It's the pestilential breath of faction poisoning the fountains of justice.
There we go. So this right here is such an indictment of how Hamilton, you know, makes accusations. I'm not surprised how this man had been faced in several duels by charges of other men. James Monroe charged him for insulting him and infaming him and demanded. I mean, these were in personal, private conversations. And the private conversation was with James Monroe, Hamilton, and Aaron Burr. And basically, Monroe was so incited, he challenged Hamilton to a duel. And it was Burr that talked Monroe off of that ledge. And later on, when Hamilton and Burr went at it, Monroe wasn't around to talk Burr off that ledge. And so Burr finally was able to do what, you know, because the two forces and the arrogance, Hamilton believing that I'll just shoot over his head and he will do the same. Man, he insulted Burr to the point where Burr made aim and made good with his intentions to get his justice. And he got it. Ah, the brutality of immediate justice. Not in the fairness of a court, but in determining who's right by the accuracy of the aim. I'm going to tell you, folks, that if we made the duel, you know, if it wasn't a capital offense, but a very painful thing to suffer, right? Let's just say, you know, we could shoot a bullet and whoever received it went through the most anguished pain the human body could take without dying. I honestly think that having the duel today with that type of outcome would be the best thing because, you know, it makes anybody think, well, you know, only those people who think that they're that much of a better shot can be tyrannical, right? And so, you know, having a duel would basically lay in favor of those who became very skilled at the draw. And actually, when you really look at the duel, it was by chance, wasn't it? And it really wasn't, you know, this, you know, out in the, you know, OK Corral. A duel was a very civil process, if you really think about it. I mean, I was kind of talking my way out of, you know, maybe, you know, the way they did it, but actually I think they did it very well. What do you think?
I like it.
Yeah, because...
And I like your idea about the excruciating pain, yeah, but no death.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would give a lot more people pause before they stood up to say something ridiculous that they couldn't back up or didn't really believe.
Right, because back in those days, they were so civil because they understood the consequences were kind of quick and immediate in the days of duel. This is why they always said the honorable gentleman. They never wanted to personally insult somebody, but they sure attacked what they said. Not them personally. But today, we're quick to attack people personally. I can tell you, I, for one, am constantly being attacked personally by patriotic organizations that want to attack me personally instead of trying to go close to what we're telling you is the truth. By reading these documents, you know, I despise. And as a matter of fact, when I look at the way I write history, I've gotten to a point where I believe offering more in citations is far more important than trying to be concise and taking my word for it. Because I realize the danger in taking the author's word. Because people can write books. A. Ralph Epperson wrote a book on the unseen hand. And I can prove he was wrong. The Constitution, the ratification debates prove he was wrong in saying Congress could legislate in any way, any fashion, over anything because of that clause. We prove that he's wrong. I've done it year after year after year. It's the same thing with Ayn Rand. It's the same thing with many people that have written books. You know, the beautiful thing out of the Ludwig von Mises Society, whatever that society is. Ludwig von Mises came to America because of the beauty of the Constitution and because the morality of our culture, of this open market Christianity. It wasn't an infliction of Christianity, it was an open market, because Mises himself was more agnostic, if not atheist. And so he kind of founded this school of thought of economics. But I appreciate his historical views, even though he editorialized, I think he possessed the credibility. You know, because when I read what he stated, he pretty much goes along with what a lot of other people stated. There are others. Friedrich Hayek is the same way. But I believe academic articles are the only way to move forward an academic text. When I say academic, I'm not meaning academic narratives. I'm meaning giving you the actual words that were said and how many times it was said to say it only needs to be said once. Because when you're talking about a contract and a compact, when one of the parties makes the assertion that this is, you know, that Congress cannot immune themselves from any law they pass, that is applied to all of Congress, and that is applied moving forward as the rule and the understanding that Congress cannot immune themselves from any law that they pass. And that was done twice in Massachusetts. It only happened in Massachusetts, but it only has to happen in one state. Because of the requirement of uniformity, because the requirement, the government cannot, you know, be different for one group of people. In other words, only the Massachusetts representatives will have to be punished. All of Congress has to be punished because they all have to equally suffer under how the Constitution was defined throughout the states. This is the beauty of this whole thing. The more you look at this, the more you start seeing how it entrapped the government and how it literally nailed them down in so many different ways, these ratification debates, how can you not see the divine hand yet? And I, granted, Sean, you haven't even started swimming in them yet. We'll get there. But as we do, you're going to start seeing, wow. Wow, this is just awesome. We've gotten through the rubber stamps, and now we're going to go into New York once we get through this. And we're almost halfway. So let's jump down into 10 now, okay? If you would, please. Thank you.
Number 10, having now examined and, I trust, removed the objection to the distinct and independent organization of the Supreme Court, I proceed to consider the propriety of the power of constituting inferior courts and the relation which will subsist between these and the former.
Yeah. Okay, so he's basically alluding to the necessity of creating inferior courts because the Supreme Court may be overran. So I honestly believe that what would have been better, and this is why I believe that the whole Article 3 needs to be reformed, or the Supreme Court needs to be completely reformed as justices of the states being appointed by the governors, that they're no longer for life, that their appointment will be based on their good behavior of preserving the Republican form of government and ensuring that the states' rights are never to be trampled over, never. Because it was the judiciary that started opening all of these doors of trampling over the rights of the people, the rights of the states, so forth and so on. And so having that, now we have a true representative court of our republic. Just like the president himself, I've alluded to, and I can't come up with a good way of doing it, you know, of using a board of directors instead of a pure executive. I think that at this point, I've not been able to come to and articulate a way of doing that better than the Electoral College and what we have currently. But what we do have currently is representative of the union and not representative of what we would call, a democracy or the people or what have you. Even though we're moving that way, we've already been pushed that way unconstitutionally. Just to be clear here, we've been pushed that way unconstitutionally because of the way they've redefined the 12th Amendment by using primaries and so forth. And the parties have been instrumental in doing this. So all this being said, I think that when we look at these inferior courts, if we had 50 justices, that would be enough for the judges to basically break into small panels to basically take care of things. Because keep in mind, folks, that nothing is to be in front of the Supreme Court unless it is actually arising under the Constitution. So these small little groups, these little committee courts, of three or five, justices, would basically quickly remand things back to the states, because that's what most of the cases today should be doing. Because if it's regarding the parks, if it's regarding energy, if it's regarding labor, if it's regarding any of these things that do not arise under the Constitution, then it should be remanded back and basically said, you've made a mistake here, this, or, you've denied these people, like I did in the case yesterday of the civil rights regarding common law cases being the controversy greater than $20. The courts just, it's a quick administrative, you violated the person's rights, you need to retry this or basically, dismiss the case. Because if you're not going to give the person the justice of a trial by jury, then you need to dismiss the case. So they just remand it back. So that's all most of these cases would be remanded back until we finally get, the whole nation into stop trying to move cases that don't belong in the federal courts out of the federal courts. And we need to do the exact same thing with cases that don't belong in the state courts. Because the state courts' jurisdictions are limited, too. They don't have unlimited. I've yet to see any state constitution where your state court has been granted the jurisdiction over cases of common law. It's just assumed. And you can't allow that to happen. So anyway, let's go on to the next one, 11. Thank you.
While we're ordering, can we get a better definition of good behavior, too? I just wanted to put that in there.
Well, you know, so good behavior goes out the window. And actually, good behavior goes out the window because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. As a matter of fact, every state constitution needs to be completely adjusted, that there's no form of impeachments when it comes to anybody that has violated their oath. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment needs to be the standard, and then we can start literally looking more and more from, you know, what we're doing moving forward. You know, because once we've got Section 3 in place to remove people, now they're, you know, if the state wants to remove somebody because of adultery, because of some moral rebate, or, you know, this atrocities or drunkenness, what have you, whatever, then that would be subjective to good behavior thing. And I would just leave that to the states to determine. If you're, you know, if you think, and I would love to see the highest morals, you know, restored. But you can't legislate morals. But if we actually start keeping people in the confines of the law, I think morals will actually be restored, because there's no reason why education can't include religion and actually giving people the truth of religion instead of allowing dogma and negative, you know, indoctrinations towards the evils of Christianity, that type of crap. Because once we've gotten the heel of government off the necks of all of us, then I think we're now moving forward.
Yeah. Okay. You can't legislate morality, but you can define it.
Yeah, you can. And as a matter of fact, technically, you can't legislate it at the state level, but you should be able. You don't want the state to legislate morality. But there's no reason why you can't have morality legislated at the lowest level possible, where the people do not want abortion to be practiced in their county, where the people do not want pornography. And eventually it will articulate into an amendment when you have enough counties to say, we the people of this state, we the counties of this state want to be free of pornography. And therefore, once you have enough of that, then the challenge is, how does the state receive data coming in? Because it would have to create portals, routing. In other words, everything that comes in, whether, and you'd have to actually make it out, I hate to say this, but this is where you start outlawing forms like Skylink, where people can bypass these things. Or actually, the state could make a law that if Skylink allows anything from an XXX, but this is where we go back to, if you want to get rid of pornography and adult material being on the internet accessible to children, all you've got to do is make the XXX domain real and force everybody into that. That if you are of any type of erotic nature or anything like that, that crosses the standards, whatever they are. And as far as I'm concerned, I think if it's an adult natured for, you know, erotica, anything, it should be in an XXX. By doing that, a state can actually say, we don't need that, we don't want that, that it can only be available to adults. Voila, then they have to create the, and they have, you know this, because I know you understand, you know, cyber threats, cyber technology, this type of stuff. They can create firewalls, they can create the way the kids would never get exposed if their parents put those measures in, or if the states provided those tools so that the parents could do that. But right now, with social media and all these other back doors, that's a different thing. Yeah, it's correct. So anyway,
they're facilitating children getting the porn.
Right. Okay, so let's go into 12.
Well, but why, it is asked, might not the same purpose have been accomplished by the instrumentality of the state courts? This admits of different answers. though the fitness and competency of those courts should be allowed in the utmost latitude, yet the substance of the power in question may still be regarded as a necessary part of the plan. If it were only to empower the national legislature to commit to them the cognizance of causes arising out of the national constitution, to confer the power of determining such causes upon the existing courts of the several states would perhaps be as much to constitute tribunals as to create new courts with the like power. But ought not a more direct and explicit provision to have been made in favor of the state courts? There are, in my opinion, substantial reasons against such a provision. The most discerning cannot foresee how far the prevalency of a local spirit may be found to disqualify the local tribunals for the jurisdiction of national causes. Whilst every man may discover that courts constituted like those of some of the states would be improper channels of the judicial authority of the Union, state judges holding their offices during pleasure or from year to year will be too little independent to be relied upon for an inflexible execution of national laws. And if there is a necessity for confiding the original cognizance of causes arising under those laws to them, when there would be a correspondent necessity for leaving the door of appeal as wide as possible, in proportion to the grounds of confidence in or distrust of the subordinate tribunals, ought to be the facility or difficulty of appeals. Okay. And well satisfied as I am of the propriety of the appellate jurisdiction in the several classes of causes to which it is extended by the plan of the convention, I should consider everything calculated to give in practice an unrestrained course to appeals as a source of public and private inconvenience.
Okay, so there's a lot of little things I want to nitpick on this, but what I'll do is I'll just highlight them because in the interest of trying to move forward, because something became a little more prevalent in my mind. We have evolved, and this is another shortcoming to this concept of a jury of your peers. Now, in those days, when we looked at crime, when we looked at what somebody was doing, the right of a trial by the jury of your peers, it didn't matter what realm your crime or what realm you were being charged for. And what I mean by realm, I mean most everybody could get educated to a degree to understand what it is or why you were doing what you were doing so that they could ensure that you were justly protected. But today we have, such, I'll just say, and this is really hard. This is very, very hard to create a jury of your peers. I believe that there's so many things today that people don't understand when we get into certain realms, that to actually create the jury of your peers cannot be done locally. Locally, in other words, if somebody is dealing with some level of science, some level of engineering, that the people, the jury themselves, could not get enough education to really understand the matter, because in the appeal itself, the burden is, did the jury have enough knowledge to really provide a verdict? Or was their verdict driven by emotions and not fact? Because understanding the facts is a huge problem when it comes to levels of technology, what have you, if that makes sense. And I think that you could literally be, a leading edge scientist in a certain field, what have you, that is out working remotely, and because the remote people think what you're doing is witchcraft or what have you, and they, put you up for a trial by jury. And you get a jury of the local people. Not one of the people understand, and you don't even have the opportunity to educate. It's all about having a speedy trial. Next thing you know, you're convicted. Whether this is a big problem or not, we are rapidly expanding into so many different realms with just not only just AI, but other things technologically, that I honestly think that there needs to be an allowance of ensuring that, because the design of our system was to ensure that a innocent man never went to jail. Not that, you know, if there's the remote chance that we could be guilty, then you go to jail. No, it's far better for a guilty man to go free than it is for an innocent man to go to jail. And the concept of, as I was looking at this, and forgive me for wandering in my head, but I've always had this. I've always wanted to, you know, kind of lay this out, that I think we really need to examine, at least for the appeals part, a way of allowing a case to actually be retried by a jury of your peers if the jury of your peers was insufficient and inadequately prepared to really judge the case. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so, because in the pursuit of ensuring that a innocent man could never go to trial, I think we've done misjustices allowing biases or, you know, these ideas to persist. Because if America started commingling with other cultures as they joined into our union, there may be these small vestiges, counties or what have you, that would look at, hey, you stole my soul with that camera. And that's a capital offense. And next thing you know, a person's being tried and they're being convicted that, you know, they go straight off to the gallows. Well, they would have the right of appeal. And this is where this would actually be able to challenge the venue and the, you know, the jury of my peers, what have you. Because you folks, you know, you may look at the people in your communities, your peers, but in some ways, in some aspects, they may not actually be true peers in profession, peers in, you know, in what you're doing with technology, intellectually, or what have you, that they may perceive a crime being committed when it's not. Okay, so without pounding on that, we've ran out of time again. So we'll pick up on paragraph 13 when we come back. Tomorrow, but anything else? Anything? Save rounds?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, I this was a real opportunity for you to fill some time, because, you know, I don't like to go on and on and on.
Oh, I know. I've noticed that.
You noticed that. Okay. So, see, I think I'm funny. I can be very self-effacing, and I can laugh at myself. I think that's a good quality in people. But anyway, all that being said, I will say this publicly. Sean, I can't appreciate enough what you and Tammy do in asking the questions, challenging me, and so forth, because I think it's important. It's so easy for me to just marginalize, because when I'm working in a vacuum, I think everybody sees things the way I do, right? That's just the common... Yeah, it's the common trend or the common propensity of anybody. Most everybody thinks that they think the way they do. And in some ways, that can be pretty dangerous for the criminally minded, because they think everybody else is a bunch of criminals. But anyway, I digress. You know, we're here providing you the facts. And I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.